From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we discover a magical book from ancient time, have interstellar negotiations, and get into trouble with some wild western zombies.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I'm one of your hosts, JM Begas, and with me is Alexander Sender Randolph III, name must be read, from North Undershire, 0.63, Boredom at Borkface, ASR3, and Jesse Anderson.
What about the
How
duck?
How are you guys doing?
Yes, I'm a duck.
You, the duck, the quack.
I'm a duck.
We're doing great. We're doing good, thank God. Like, it's been a busy week. I mean, Kickstarters have been dropping left, right, and center. I've been trying to play as many games as I possibly can, because that ultimately is the only reason I do what I do, so I can play board games. There's no other reason, rhyme, or anything else. It's all about the Boardy McBoardface. I mean, about the board games.
Do it for the burbs.
Speaking of birds, Jesse, we have some kind of big news on Monday, is it? Is
Wingspan
that when that's scheduled?
Wingspan expansion?
I don't think so. Although we do need to figure out a way to get into the new Mythical expansion that has been hinted at by Stone Meyer.
Wait,
Games.
There's a Mythical expansion?
They have hinted at a Mythical Bird expansion.
So the Quackalope is in there, 100%.
That's begging for a Quackalope.
I mean, it really has
it's
to be.
It's confirmed at this point.
I am reaching out to Jamie immediately after this podcast to confirm.
Don't do that.
Oh, no, it's done. It's already done.
Can I also send an email? I think I'm also sending. I basically have that guy's number at this point.
I saw it on the Facebook page, and I don't know if it's anything official from Stone Meyer. All I know is that the fans were asking.
So what mythical birds would be either like a phoenix? What else would be in there?
A zebra.
A what?
A zebra.
Zebra.
Jan, you're so narrow-minded. But with all that, thank you so much for joining us on today's show. And for those who are new to the Weekly Quack, welcome. This is a board game variety podcast, apparently organized mostly around birds, but also three main segments. Shelf or Sell, where we debate whether a game is entering or leaving our collection.
You're getting rid of it.
The Medley Minute, a quick reprise about birds and board game news and other musings, and On the Radar, where we discuss upcoming games about birds and why we're excited for them. Also, at the end of the show, we take time to go through.
I love the direction this show is going.
It's the Weekly Quack. It has to be about birds. What are people expecting here? Board games?
Speaking of, you've never done Foul Moment like in four episodes, Jesse. I'm hoping you change the tide this time.
Fun fact, Jen, you can't use never unless there is
too much of a good thing.
You can't use never unless there's an infinity at either end. I will never do this again. I have never done that. You can't say I've never done something in four episodes. That introduces a cap at both ends. But all that aside, completely unrelated, Jan, what are you bringing to Shelf or Sell this week?
So today on Shelf or Sell, I am bringing, is this considered a throwback in today's gaming age? A game from 2019. I feel it's been...
Oh, it's ancient. You can't talk about that.
Yeah, right? It does feel ancient.
I'm kind of aghast that you're bringing it in.
I'm bringing Obscurio, boys. Have you heard of this one before?
I mean, it's 2019. If I heard about it, I already forgot.
Yeah, I wasn't playing games back then.
Okay. Obscurio is a 2-8 cooperative deduction party game published by Libelude and designed by L'Atelier. In the game, players have been trapped in an abandoned library by an evil wizard with no chance of escape. Until, that is, they stumble into a magical grimoire. The grimoire is tasked with giving out clues and riddles to lead the players outside before their tie to reality is completely severed. Each round, the grimoire will draw one card face down and create hints to help the team towards the correct exit. Working together, the other players have to find the exit card as quickly as possible while avoiding picking the wrong cards. However, a member of the team is a traitor looking to lead the other players astray by feeding the selection with confusing options. The players win if they're able to successfully exit the sixth room with at least one cohesion token remaining on the board.
You're telling me that this is a party game with a hidden traitor mechanic.
I concede that that was a very complex description for what is actually a very straightforward
deception,
game.
Murder in Hong Kong will also fall into that category.
Yes, correct.
Here's what I'm thinking. Whether or not you're getting rid or keeping this game, I'm picking it up immediately. Because if everyone's listened to this podcast, they know a party game with a hidden traitor mechanic, about the best game you could give me.
See, I find it fascinating because, like, in real life, the concept of, like, trying to figure out a puzzle while people intentionally misinform you just sounds like torture. But call it a board game and give it an objective and sign me right up. I'm down.
Well, Jesse, have you ever played Mysterium before?
I haven't. I'm not intrigued. I haven't played either of these games. I'm not very familiar with them. I just have to say I am not compelled by your description of it.
So it's interesting. I'm semi-compelled, but I have played Mysterium, and generally games with gorgeous art and a set of rules have been intriguing to me. Practically speaking, most of them haven't lasted in my collection aside from the original OG, Dixit. The art in Obscurio looks absolutely amazing. I want to pick up this game and the art alone.
I like Dixit being the original OG.
Well, it is.
Dixit is the original OG. Absolutely. When it comes to bizarre art that looks like somebody was high when they came up with the game or drew stuff, I mean, it has to be. Although the art in Obscurio does look absolutely amazing, I'm almost inclined to pick this up just so I can shuffle it in with my Dixit cards or something. I need to do that with all these games. Pick up Mysterium again, give them all like heavy back sleeves, just so I can shuffle up a ton of different cards into my Dixit collection and not bother playing the rest of these games.
And Jesse, let me see if I can give you a non-scripted description of this game to see if that clears up what you do.
Maybe that'll do it.
Basically, there's one person that's trying to have everybody else guess the correct card. At the beginning of every round, that player is going to draw that card. They're going to look at it, and then they're going to put it face down, and they're going to draw two random ones. What they do with those two random cards is that they then point out details in the artwork that allude to the card that the players have to choose. After that, though, things start getting a little bit more complicated. That those two cards that have the details pointed out get passed across all the players, and then everybody closes their eyes. When everybody closes their eyes...
Honestly, I'm more confused than I was before. I like the original description.
Yeah, and I'm just going to clarify, you were trying to give a description for me, and you had me at the beginning. You were like, we're going to give a little bit of aesthetic, maybe a tiny bit of theme, you know, and then you started going more and more heavy mechanics, and once again... you lost me. So my vote is
the theme early.
I know you pretended to give me the theme. My vote is you are getting rid of this game. You don't love it enough.
More than that, I mean, this game's player count is really well suited to higher player counts, and I just don't see this.
He doesn't have that many
soon.
Friends. Yeah,
you don't.
And
yeah,
along
yeah.
with that, along with that, Jan, I'm also doing a second vote. You're keeping Dixit.
Wow.
I don't know if that counts, Jesse.
Wow. Okay, you're both completely off. I absolutely love Obscurio.
What are you talking about?
And the reason why I'm bringing
wrong.
This one
no,
in
you're wrong.
Is so
yeah,
that
you're wrong,
this game that has been obscured for so long, I ideally want more people to know about it because I think it's actually one of the better, what do you call these type of games? Like deduction picture games out there, period.
All right. Defend your position, because I know you've been looking, as a friend knowledge, I know you've been looking at these sort of deduction-style games for a while. It's a genre that, for some reason, intrigues and brings your attention to it. Why is this one staying? Because so far, you've not convinced Alex or I that you really do like this game.
No, I mean, if he's saying that he's keeping it so he can mix the cards with Dixit, then I'm totally on board.
Fair. Are you, in fact, mixing the cards with Dixit?
There's no way you can do that, because these cards are circles.
Oh, no.
So there's no way you can mix the cards.
That has no merit whatsoever.
You could trim off the edges and sleeve them in square holders.
That sounds sacrilegious.
Alternatively, you can play with Dixit rules and exclusively these circle cards.
Are you doing that?
Okay, everybody, listen. The reason why I like this game, beyond it being attached to a really nice memory I had in Gen Con 2019, is that I feel that this is the gamer's Dixit. Or the gamer's Mysterium.
I love recommending a game that's attached to a memory no one else can share.
I said besides. So what makes this game particularly special beyond the artwork and the amazing components is actually the specificity that you can have in this genre game that I haven't seen anywhere else. As I was trying to describe before, one of the issues that I at least had with Dixit or Mysterium is that you have to be very vague in the way that you're giving out information. In this game, you're super specific. You have these little tiny magnetic pieces that you're able to literally plop on top of this artwork and say, this is what I want you to look at. This is the other thing I want you to look at. That is one element that I feel is really nice and starts giving the game a lot of gravitas. Beyond that, the element of the hidden traitor here is actually really intriguing because the way that it's done, it doesn't really deter or detract too much from the game and keeps everything very, spicy and interesting constantly. When players are trying to choose the right card, the trader can choose to put in cards that will confuse everybody else into the mix. And because they're also part of the team of deduction where they're trying to convince everybody what's what, they're able to lead people in the wrong direction and maybe start getting points or things across that might not be what you want to happen. And the top thing, my favorite thing about this game is that every round is different because there are traps and different elements that you are adding on top of this artwork. For example, there's these layers or filters that you can add that completely take away all the color from the artwork. There's other filters that you can add that start putting on top elements where you can't even see what's actually underneath the artwork. And there's just this complexity to the game that doesn't necessarily make it into an overwrought party game. And I don't even know if I call this straight up party game.
All right.
It's genuinely really good and fun.
You have me much that your third attempt was your strongest
it's
by far.
It's not an attempt. I'm just describing what I like about it.
I am not only intrigued and compelled by the game, but I would like to try it. But I do have an important question because Alex brought up the player count. What is the best? Like, what have you played this
that
at?
Is a good
Where
question.
Do you think it functions at? Because you're talking about it as a party game. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a lot of these hidden role mechanics where at least one person has to be sectioned off to be the leader. And then you need people that are able to balance and debate between them.
Yep.
So that means a minimum of four.
Yep.
And I would assume it probably plays better with more and more.
Yeah, so this game does allow for a 2-8 player cooperative
nope,
experience.
It's lying.
I have no
it
idea how that works. I would 100% say if there's nothing you can do, just try the 4-player variant, but I think 5 to 6 is going to be the sweet spot. 8 should be fine, but I think it might add a little bit too much downtime with all the discussion. Oh, and speaking of downtime, another fun thing about this game is that there is a little timer that is always forcing people to go as fast as possible. Because if you're slow with making a decision, you get more trap tokens added to the next round. So, like I'm saying...
I do like that.
Like I'm saying, this is if you've ever played Mysterium before and you thought, like, this is a neat game, but I don't know if it's worth it for people that, like, play board games more often... Obscurio, you seriously got to try it. I think it's the best one out of all of them. With that said, I haven't played the latest Mysterium, but I bet it can't beat this either.
Well, Jen... I'm glad you're keeping it. I am very glad. And I do want to know, just like the next time you actually play this game, just make sure to make a note of it when we do that episode's weekly quack. I'm very intrigued.
You know one thing that we should definitely include on this show? I don't know when exactly we need to do this, but we need to revisit past shows on all the games that we have shelved and then give an update on what happened with each one of those games.
I think that is an excellent idea. I'm totally down.
Yeah, for
sure. And with that, for my shelf of sale this week, I'm bringing in a game that I know both of you have played.
Oh.
And that game is going to be Moonmakers by Ivy Studios. Gosh.
Okay.
So okay. I don't actually know what your opinion is of this game. I do know you've played it.
With Sarah
and
Shaw.
I don't need your opinion for this segment. Oh, ooh, fun. Mm-hmm. So I don't know your opinion yet. We can get into that shortly. But what's right important right now is my opinion. But before we get into that, Moonmakers is a deck building game in which you are negotiating with other players to accomplish missions together. And if that sounds like a bit like a mouthful, which I guess that's the theme of the evening, just a conglomerate of components and mechanics and hodgepodge all together in different games. But Moonmakers is actually pretty simple when it comes down to it. You're ultimately trying to get 10 points, and every turn, players are going to take turns being the captain as they select a mission that they can then invite the other players to. Think about Cosmic Encounter if you've ever played that. And then once the other players agree or don't agree and everyone is on the same page, you basically divide up the rewards of that mission. Rewards will be points, money, and more cards that will help improve your engine. And so once you come to a firm agreement, if you don't come to an agreement, you have to restart, pick another mission, and you get 3 tries there. Alternatively, once all the players agree, you start playing cards from your hand to accomplish the mission. And this is where it's going to have hints or notes of dominion in it. You can only play one action at a time unless you play cards that give you additional actions. And so you're trying to build out a deck that lets you tackle the cards in the most efficient way possible while working with others in a way that both helps yourselves and helps others as you slowly but surely progress towards 10 victory points, which may not seem like a lot, but the hazards you encounter each mission will ding away at your victory points. And so you're trying to accomplish missions, gain more points, build up a better engine, stop yourself from getting dinged with hazard dice and losing your points, try to convince the other players. One of my favorite mechanics in any games is trying to constantly convince other players that you are not winning the game when you actually are. Doing that the entire time until eventually one player either wins or doesn't, and another player wins instead, because there will be a winner in this game. And that, I would say, is the condensed version of how Moonraker's plays.
I am really intrigued by this one. We have played it. I own a copy. I think Ivy Studios has done an incredible job with their first board game, their first foray into this space. Production was out of this world. See what I did there? See anyone?
That's cute. Thank you. I picked up on it. I ignored it. Didn't want to reward your bad behavior.
No. Yeah, well, I did it without realizing and then thought I'd mention that it was done. That being said, I do have one major critique of this game, and I'm curious if that critique is enough for you to not keep it. I find when you get to end game, you have this cyclical nature of no one really wanting to help you out. So it slows down the game, and I think it can last a few rounds too long instead of having this crescendo ending. Now, I do want more plays, so I can see if you can build and strategize around that being the consequence of the way that the cooperative system works. I think you're keeping this. I think there was enough to compel you to keep it on the shelf at least for a few more plays.
So, Alex, you've said in the past...
Now we proceed to the barrage of 14 different questions.
No, Jen. You've said in the past that you and I have similar-ish tastes in games, right?
We do, yes.
Okay, you're not keeping it.
An excellent deduction. Why, may I ask?
Because I didn't like it.
But what did you not like about it?
Oh, I thought I couldn't expand. I was trying to keep it nice and brisk.
No, expand. And if you can include birds in the reason why, I'd love to know.
Birds would be wonderful.
A bird did beat me at this game, so maybe that could apply.
That is a factor. Yeah. That is a factor.
I don't know. I didn't feel that the deck building was enjoyable in this. I didn't necessarily think that the way that the conversations and arguing and just the plain what's the term? The plain cooperation between players was
I believe the term is
negotiation.
Circus.
Negotiation. Mm. Thank you, Jesse. Serpents was exactly
aviary is the word you're
what
looking
I was
for.
Looking yeah. for. The negotiation in this wasn't really that compelling at all. And the card play was really basic. I didn't have the combo-tastic feeling that I get in a lot of deck builders that I truly enjoy. The
combo-tastic!
The way that you would eventually evolve your player is nice and interesting, but at the same time, it is not enough to keep the rest of the elements in the game to shine enough. I don't know. There was nothing about this game in particular that made me go, I definitely want this in my collection. Would I play it again? Yeah, of course I'd play it again. It was fine. Just not something that
Jen,
I would come back to.
I definitely want this in my collection.
Okay. Then we're not the same then. Darn it.
Alex,
so,
are you keeping
Moonraker's,
it?
Absolutely, I'm keeping it. At least for now. Now, Jen is not completely wrong, keep in mind. Jen did touch upon a few notes.
Never forgets.
Jen touched upon a few notes that about this game, Moonraker's is a game that I really enjoy what it's bringing to the table. And what it's doing offhand is it's very unique in the way it combines mechanics and the way that works, which means offhand, it's starting off on a good foot, on a good ledge, because I can't compare it equitably to any other game in my collection. It has the negotiation of cosmic encounter in a way that actually works, and the deck building, while not as rewarding as some of the deck building games that I have, is compelling enough once you combine it with that negotiation, that tactical, that backstabbery. Now, Jesse, we did not experience that slowdown endgame.
How many
I think
people
this
did you
might
play
come
with?
Down to. We played it with four.
Okay.
And I think that might be already, because you played it with three, right?
We played four. It with four.
Oh, you
and
played
it
with
was
four.
Eternal. Like, it was so bad.
So this is one of those things where I don't know how you're building out your decks, but if you properly build out your ships and properly build out your decks, combined with the fact that you can always cycle a few missions on the table, I think there's always going to be a mission on the table you can realistically attempt a solo play towards the end of the game. So what we had in our group is everyone kept on trying to up themselves, even while upping others, hoping, thinking, praying that a 3-point gap was not enough for them to bridge alone. And yet, at the table, Shira, who you've met, you've met Jesse, she managed to get to 7 points and then accomplished two objectives and a mission all at once,
wow.
and creep out that win. And we were like, "Come on! We thought we had more time to deny you." But you have to combine those objectives. You have to sneak up on people. You have to let them think that they are holding you at bay as they try to further themselves. But really, you're about to win.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you were able to directly address one of my concerns. Again, only one play experience. And so both of our experiences may be accurate. But if that exists in this game to where as long as I know the game well enough and am strategizing well enough, the players around the table don't have to rely on everyone else to give them the victory at the end of the game. I am much, much, much more compelled about getting this one to the table again quickly, not with Jan, and seeing if it's one that wants to stay in my collection.
I didn't do anything correctly.
But you don't enjoy the game, Jan.
And I can try it again.
I do my best to not make you uncomfortable unless I'm telling you to come look at beautiful deer.
So it happens to be what you're saying. I can see players, depending on their own group meta, falling into that trap. That trap of saying, Shira won when she was at 7 points, so next time we can't let her get to 7. We have to stop her at 6.
Well, and listen, I want to clarify right now, I, for the record, always advocate for stopping Shira at 5, but y'all never listen to me.
Yeah, but I think that players can fall into the trap of being too focused on stopping others from winning that they don't focus on trying to win.
100%.
If you are constantly trying to win and you always try to leave yourself enough buffer that they're not safe, then I think players will fall in, will fall through by getting those extra objectives. And it's actually interesting because when I was reading the rules, I remember thinking like they have this specific rule of those secret objectives that you have about how, well, if you don't reveal it right away, you can't claim it later. And I was like, that's unnecessarily, restrictive. Like, who cares? If someone forgot the objective from 2 turns ago, just let them accomplish it. Why are we being so strict? And I think the reason for that strictness is because it's literally part of the game. Very often in this game, you might accomplish an objective, but it's better to hold on to it and try to accomplish it on that final turn. If you can knock out a few bonus points with your objectives in that final turn when people aren't seeing it coming, I think that's how you can get in the win when people think that they're still holding you back a little bit.
Interesting. I'm so glad you liked it.
It's excellent. Absolutely excellent. It does need a, so going to Jan's point, it does need an expansion though. I do want more cards, more deck building, more choice in the way that I build up my experience. I did feel a little bit more like a traveler along that journey as opposed to driving the ship.
And
see what I did there, Jesse?
I didn't. I wasn't listening. Jan and I are much more deck builders as well when it comes to our gameplay experience. And so for us, that part not feeling as rewarding as some of the other deck building systems that we've played, I think is a fair criticism, and I would love to see something
Absolutely.
Come out that enhances it, because it's one of the mechanics that we both circumnavigate to. See what I did there?
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely, totally. And so everyone listening to this podcast, I think it's clearly your job now. It's clearly your job to go ahead and buy this game, because that will incentivize Ivy Studios to put out another expansion, which would ultimately make our experience better. And that's what this podcast is all about. It's about making our experience better.
Right. That sounds right.
Very, very convincing, Alex. Very convincing. Jesse, what about you? What are you bringing in today?
I'm bringing in 2 small box titles. I am bringing in The Lost Ruins of Arnok, and I am bringing in Dune Imperium.
Oh,
Jesse, you and I have to have a talk about the nature of what it means to be a small box title.
Yep.
I used to do the same thing.
My introduction to this hobby was Kingdom Death. So as far as I'm concerned, everything's affordable.
Dune Imperium and Lost Ruins of Arnok are absolutely small box titles.
Small
I hear
box
titles,
yeah, absolutely. So I'm bringing in both of these because there are 2 worker placement deck building systems, games of which Alex has covered, we've talked about, I believe other people have brought them into the channel, but I've now finally had the opportunity to play both of them. And so I thought it'd be fair to, instead of splitting it between multiple episodes, let's bring these worker placement deck building games in and have a conversation about them. In Dune Imperium, you're going to be, placing workers and building your deck. There's going to be the lore and mythos of the Dune literature set in the background. And for the most part, you're going to be deciding what card you want to play, either for resources to purchase cards to upgrade your hand, or what card you want to play to go to different worker locations. Each card is going to have a different symbol or iconography that opens up various regions across the landscape. You'll be collecting resources that can be utilized to take different types of actions or unlock certain actions on the board. For instance, having salt can hire more military. There's going to be a large feature in this game which has to do with military squabbles, where you're going to be recruiting your troops, sending them into this middle battle zone and resolving who is the victor. And like most games like this, whoever races to the top of the, not most games like this. This is a game that has a victory point track that is based off of a race system. Whoever crosses the finish line first is going to be the winner. So dynamics like how you build your deck, where you place your workers, and whether or not you win conflicts really does become a pressure point to how you're playing the game. Everyone's escalating together. The other game, Lost Ruins of Arnok, is going to be a worker placement deck building game. But this is going to be much more of a Euro-style one for me than I think Dune Imperium was. In Lost Ruins of Arnok, you're going to be pushing up various, what I would say, approachable and recognizable chains. You have production trees that are going to be unlocking or sequencing new resources as you push higher. You're going to be placing your workers in different regions that you are exploring and using the movement icons on your various cards to determine where you can push and how far you can place your workers. You'll also be facing off with giant beasts and creatures that are across this island landscape and doing your very best to, well, like you'd expect, score the most victory points possible, not necessarily pass a specific threshold before other players. The game is going to be controlled over a series of rounds. I believe it's 5 or 6 before the game ends. And throughout that process, you'll be drawing up your hand of cards, purchasing cards from the market, and playing those cards to, again, activate and place your workers, collecting resources, trading those resources for farther or more advanced actions, or to take out larger creatures and score victory points. Both of them are fairly thematic. Both of them are reasonably aesthetically pleasing, with Lost Ruins of Arnok being more beautiful, and both of them are 2020 titles.
Now, are these games entering or leaving as a set? I know I'm going to completely disregard for
Neither.
A second the clear and blatant violation of the rules of Shelf or Sell.
Neither. Both of these games are individually categorized. I just thought I would bring them both in at the same time instead of splitting them between multiple conversations.
I mean, we can do an extra podcast a week if you want to try to just cover more stuff.
We can, Alex. You have 12 children and you have no time. 3 jobs, 12
That's
children.
Weird. I mean, I do love a lot of my board games. I wouldn't call them children.
Yeah, but the 3 jobs, that's the problem.
So I'm going to withdraw my vote until after Jan has gone, because having played at least one of these games with you, I think I have a little bit more information. I'm still not completely in the know here, but I'll go after Jan in this case.
You're going to sell both of them, because there's another contender here that you haven't mentioned yet. And based on what I know about you, you prefer it a lot more than both of these.
What is the other contender, Jan?
I would assume he's referring to Endless Winter.
Yes,
what?
I am.
Another title. A new battler has entered the ring.
Super Smash Bros.
Endless Winter is also going to be a worker placement deck building game that also was available in 2020, but not for other people to play. We had a prototype of it. We did some coverage, if only my mouth would work appropriately as I doth speaketh. And it is going to be delivering, hopefully, end of this year, early next year from, you know, to the backers that supported it on Kickstarter.
To be fair, I do believe that the TTS version of the game is publicly available for those who do want to play it. And so it technically is available for anyone to play.
Interesting. Endless Winter. Alex, do you want to give a quick, brief preview? Because I know you are a big fan of this title.
Sure. So the short summary is going to be exactly what we talked about already. You're going to be doing a deck building worker placement.
Oh,
you're going
to
be playing it across 4 rounds in which you're going to be taking your chieftain as well as your other tribe members, placing them on a few different locations on the board. The primary area of the board you're going to be fighting over is 4 different main action spots, from hunting to movement on a sideboard to building out your deck. And the last one escapes me offhand, but it's 4 different spots you're going on. Collecting animals, that's the one. Hunting animals. And then you're going to be, each time you go to a spot, you're going to have a first player reward that is pretty powerful. And then there's all kinds of these mishmash of different things going on from these different, from that animal collection, from that sideboard, from building monoliths, a whole bunch of things that honestly feels kind of messy, or I should rephrase that, seems like it'll feel kind of messy, but ultimately it all works together.
It has a lot of modules and operates off of that same core system.
But
deck building, yeah, worker placement.
That is not the games we're talking about. That is the side conversation.
Is it not, Jan?
What about?
Is it not the
what
true
about
game we're talking about?
Dune and Lost Ruins of Arnak. Alex, what is your call?
So I brought in. That's a good point.
I mean, I specifically think that... Given my play of Dune with Jesse, and given Jesse's general reluctance and lack of enthusiasm around Dune, which honestly I can't fault him, I had the same lack of enthusiasm, at least comparatively to these other titles, just because I wasn't visually drawn in. But I don't think Jesse's keeping Dune. I think he wasn't as enamored with it. I think he thinks it's fine, but not a contender for a standout game and whatnot. Versus Lost Winds of Arnak, I think he did enjoy it enough to be worth keeping. I mean, Endless Winter may well be better, but I think Lost Winds of Arnak had enough and is pretty enough and made you feel like you're doing enough fun things that I think Lost Winds of Arnak is one that's worth keeping.
Okay. I have to say, Jan, you're 100% right.
I knew it. In
the battle of the boxes, when it comes to deck building worker placement games, I am comparing these three, just like Alex has done in the past, just like many people have done in the past. Alex, you came to the same conclusion. Endless Winter, as far as we can read right now, is the best out of these titles. Now, granted, it's not delivered yet. It still has a lot of, you know, room and work to go. But I know the developers behind it. I've been able to play the prototype, and I'm just super excited about what they have arriving. Dune Imperium was as lackluster as I was expecting. It is a perfectly fine game that I have no desire to own or much interest in playing again. Now, I understand why people like it. Don't get me wrong. I think it does a pretty good job at representing the mythology and the books. I think it aesthetically even has some compelling traits to it. The cards are lovely in their own way, and it has its own custom artwork. I also think that the pressure of the battle system and the squeeze on resources is done really well. But just the way that I want to experience the game, the way that I want to enjoy a deck building worker placement or a Euro, I didn't find that this game really struck a chord for me. Now, would I refuse to play it? No, I'd sit down and play it without any complaints, but it's not one that's going to be pulled off the shelf whenever I'm suggesting games that I want to get to the table. Now, Lost Ruins of Arnak is an interesting one because I was very compelled by the artwork, the progression, and the narrative story of it. But the multiple times I've sat down and either opened the box, started reading the rulebook again, or experienced and played or watched other people play this game, I have to say it's just not staying in my collection. I don't think or regret telling anyone to pick up this game. I understand, again, why so many people are head over heels about it. I think the systems and mechanics are fun, but after three or four experiences with it, it's not one that is continuing to compel my interest the same way it did the first time I played it. Both of these titles are going on. They're not being sold or anything like that. I'm giving them to some friends that I think will enjoy them and get them to the table a lot more often than I will. And the whole reason and debate in my mind is simply, will I, over the course of the next year, before Endless Winter arrives, go out of my way to pull these off the shelf and play them? And I just don't see myself doing it.
It's interesting. It's all these games are, more specifically, Dune Imperium and Lost Ruins of Arnak, they've only just come out, both of them at the end of 2020, and already both of them are in the top 300 at BoardGameGeek. And I predict by the end of 2021, I would imagine both of these will crack the top 100.
I wouldn't be upset if they did. I'm not anti these games. I'm just not.
Jesse, I'm building a case as to why you're wrong, and let me do that. I think Endless Winter is also going to follow that same trajectory of once it hits, it's within a year, I think it's going to be a top 100 material. All three of these games are excellent. Now, I am right there with you in thinking that Endless Winter is the best, followed by Arnak, followed by Dune Imperium. So we do share the same hierarchy, but I think all of them are absolutely incredible. All of them are deserving of that climb, of that rise. And all of them are games that I will not only be willing to play, but will happily suggest, pull out, get expansions when they come out, because they're all rewarding in uniquely different ways.
Alex, you know, that is exactly what I wanted to bring into the conversation right now, because I feel that there's one thing that we're forgetting. How many worker placements are there out there? How many point salad euros out there? I think that the combination between worker placement and deck builder as a main conceit or genre is just starting. And I think that we are all very lucky that it has started with such strong contenders in there. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because each of these different titles is focusing on very different styles of play that could potentially be right for a lot of different people, depending on what they're looking for. If I were to condense it very simply, I would say the Dune Imperium, if there are people that are looking for a more traditional worker placement game that has a lot of interesting intrigue when it comes to conflict and tension as the game progresses.
That's the one thing about Dune Imperium that I believe is the standout. I think that the deck building in this one is a little bit lesser, but it's still there and it still adds to the experience. As for Lost Ruins of Arnak, Lost Ruins of Arnak is a much more traditional deck builder with a lot of interesting experiences on how you build up the board. So I really like that idea of exploration that this game brings while also keeping the deck building front and center. The way that the tracks work, etc., and the way that the point system works in here is not as interesting as I thought it was in Dune Imperium. It's a little bit more muddied, and you never really know what other players are doing, which for a worker placement Euro can be beneficial for some players and can be a negative for others. So that's another thing to consider. And finally, I think the reason why you two specifically are so excited about Endless Winter is because it leans much more on the Eurocentric side, where it's a combination of different puzzles coming together around the mechanic of deck building, and it does well in how it functions through that. But the deck building to me in Endless Winter feels more like I felt with Rococo, where it's more of a tool in order to get my actions moving and going. So the deck building is also not the star there, but the Euro and the mechanics and the puzzles that exist in Endless Winter are the strongest elements of it. So ultimately, at the end of the day, these are three completely separate games in what they're trying to do. And I agree with you, Alex, 100%. I just wanted to give a little bit more context as to why they're all incredible and to let people know, like, hey, if any of these sound interesting to you right now, go ahead and get Dune Imperium or go ahead and get Lost Ruins of Arnak, because I am 100% confident that you will love these. Because as Alex said, they're going into the top 100 eventually.
Yeah, what I do find intriguing about these titles, though, is that we all seem to have the same priority system of which we like, and yet Dune Imperium does seem to be the crowd favorite, edging out Lost Ruins of Arnak
really?
By a decent chunk of points.
I'm kind of surprised about that.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, because people already know this about Jesse just said it in this episode, I think for me, Lost Ruins of Arnak might be edging closer to being my favorite amongst these two, but I'm also a really big fan of the Euro elements. With that said, I would probably keep both Lost Ruins right now and Endless Winter in my collection at the end of the day.
Again, same hierarchy system, though. Very interesting. The thing that you brought up that I'm intrigued by, Jan, is Rococo a deck building worker placement?
No. It's not a worker placement game. It is a deck building Euro game. And that's what I was trying to get
to. Yeah. Very compelling, because it's not worker placement, but it is like action selection, and you're going and wow. Either way, I love Rococo. That's staying in my collection.
Settle down, settle down. It's time for our Medley Minute, a moment of respite before the rest of our show.
Okay, boys. So today on the Medley Minute, we got a few things to talk about, and I'm going to
start. First?
Oh, you want to start? No. Go ahead. What are you bringing in, Jesse?
I have a very important announcement. It is probably one of the biggest announcements we've ever had on the channel, and people are going to find out next Monday. So we'll hold off on that announcement. The thing I do want to talk about, though, did you like how I teased the audience there?
I did. I thought you were teasing a different way. I was about to say that guarantees that this is not at all important.
So here's no. The announcement could be the beginning or end of everything.
It is important to Jesse.
That guarantees
here
that it's not at all the beginning or end of anything.
Yep. Here is what I want to say, though. I have recently discovered a window. That window has a view. That view looks out over a farm, a pasture with bird boxes and a giant field for deer to graze in. And I have spent hours upon hours observing the world. I think that window is better than any TV show, movie, nearly any experience that I've had. So I want to encourage our listeners to first off, look out a window. Second off, hang a bird feeder. And third off, if you see deer, take longer than Jan did. Jan, you spent 5 seconds looking at those deer, and then you said, huh, and left. I'd spent 40 Jen, minutes watching them move across the field in graze. How dare you?
Jan, that is disgusting. I don't know why you took 4 seconds longer than you need to.
Oh, Thank you,
Alex.
All right.
All this
being said, I do want to let the audience know some very specific and important discoveries. I have this week observed a Dowley woodpecker. It's a little striped black and white bird. Oh, you can notice it by the ornate design on its headpiece. It is the smallest woodpecker in North America. Uses its little tail to lean up and lean back against the wood. It migrates all up and down the northeast and the east, all the way from Florida up to Maine. You can identify them by how small, adorable, and striped that they are. And I have also this week observed a black-capped chickadee, which is another Jan? What do you want?
I was just gonna say yeah. that mm-hmm. for people listening, this might sound like a spiritual journey, like look through the window of your soul. Jesse literally means a window yeah. that is just uh-huh. looking outside. Yep. That's all it is.
Okay. And with that, I will continue to update you on the birds that I have observed and learned about from this point until perpetuum.
Oh my God. So is the foul moment now just becoming this bird watching thing, Jesse? Is that what it's going to be from now on?
I've spent more time watching a single bird feeder than I've spent on nearly anything this last week.
I regret
not a second of it.
I don't understand you. Okay. And here's another thing I don't understand. For my Mentally Minute of the Day, I'm bringing in a little bit of controversy. Apparently, a certain Kickstarter has been taken down after it was successfully funded. And that Kickstarter is Ratlands by Roxley Games, which comes as a bit of a shocker.
Oh, I did see
yes.
this.
I've done some research on it, so I'm curious to see if you have any information.
Oh, I have information.
Yeah,
oh,
so interesting. So we all have information.
I don't think there's necessarily a lot to talk about, but I can give you a little bit of context. So apparently a artist by the name of Mr. Crayola has risen up some alarm bells that his design and his concept around a 25 card game that he had made back a few years ago called Ratlands was being inappropriately used for Ratlands by Roxley. He has supposedly said that both the conceit of the game, the concept behind Ratlands, his Ratlands, and also the aesthetic and the art style is eerily similar to what he had been working on and where he supposedly had a backlog of information and Facebook groups and a bunch of other data that dates back, I believe, 3 years ago.
Yes, that sounds right.
Yeah, and he's now claiming that his content and his art has been stolen or has been used inappropriately for this new game that is being done. And so Roxley is on their game. They have already addressed the fan base with this, and they have also started conversations with Kickstarter to try and get this remedied. They have assured the fans that this game is 100% under the guise and creation of Roxley Games and its designers, and was in no way, shape, or form taken from any independent artist anywhere. A lot of people, there's threads on BGG talking about this right now. It's currently at 83 posts, 4 pages of people just commenting and saying, like, I don't think that this guy has a lot of legs to stand on right now. What they're looking, what the things that they're commenting is mostly conjecture. I can see a little bit of similarity, but it isn't enough. There's a Mickey Mouse in here. So, like, what happens if Disney catches him? There's a bunch of stuff going on. What do you guys know about this?
So overall, I know everything you said is on point. I know that during the campaign as well, this was already being brought up. This person was showing up in the comments and talking about this.
Commented
that same
very
idea
early
of,
on, I believe.
Yeah, very early on in the campaign. And people assumed that it would go nowhere. I mean, it's a reasonable assumption. It's a person who has, like, an IP that is, I mean, it's Radlands, which the name already conjures up the same idea. So it could be coincidence. It could be taken. All these things are possible. In terms of where this goes next or what happens next, I don't anticipate much. I figure worst case scenario, absolute worst case scenario, you'll see a change in the name of the game. That is likely the worst thing that will happen. The idea of copyrighting the colors when they didn't overlap that much, they just had a general neon flavor to it, or the mechanics, which had no overlap whatsoever, those things are going to be impossible. To have any kind of enforcement over. On Kickstarter's side of things, there is no reason or incentive for them to not take down the page right now. The money from the campaign has already been made. There's nothing to gain by leaving it up. They just open themselves up to potential damages if they leave it up. They've already gotten their money. So Kickstarter's playing it safe, and they should. They're doing everything exactly the way they're supposed to.
I don't have enough information on any sides of this to really dig in. The name is really where I done most of my information. It looks like there's potential for a name change, which would be intriguing, but I'm on the same point as you, Alex. I don't see a lot of other overlap. I do feel for indie designers and indie creators. I know that it is a thing that is done. There are cases where people have lost designs, had things copied, have ideas stolen, and I don't have enough information on any side of this to know if there is any overlap. It does not look like it from the information that we have right now, but I don't want to double down on something that I just don't know enough about. What I do know is, I think you're right on Kickstarter playing it safe, but it kind of stinks too, because it's made it very hard for this company to communicate with the fan base that has now backed their project. It's a really unfortunate situation just when it comes to us, the consumer. I don't know about the corporate side of things, but as a consumer, it is uncomfortable, feels unstable, and the lack of ease of communication due to limiting factors that have been placed in front of that by Kickstarter has been frustrating.
And in case if you haven't been able to check out the Instagram from Mr. Crayola, I honestly, genuinely believe that the only art asset that Radlands has that is almost similar, and not even by that much, but similar to what his style is just the cover. Everything else feels very Dice Thrones and has very, you know, very slight tones of neon. Yeah, I'm sad in general about Mr. Crayola, like him putting in work for this game for so long, and now having a much larger title take the wind out of his sails is definitely unfortunate. I think it could have been approached with a lot more discretion and understanding, and try to get to a point where everyone was happy.
The hard part to know is, was Roxley aware of his title? Did they know about the name, or as things happen, is it just a situation where, unfortunately, they are a large enough company that when they publish a title under a name that they come up with, it zeroes out everyone else? Mm-hmm. It's sort of the debate. Yep. It's sort of the debate we made around Quackalope. When we first came up with our terminology, we did so in a way that hoped to secure the IP for ourselves. If you search online, there are very few, if not no other things that exist around Quackalope. Now, if a studio like Disney decided that they wanted to come up with a little horned duck, well, first off, I'm going after Disney. No holds barred. Second off, though, I really don't know. I feel for everyone involved. I mostly feel for the consumer.
For myself, for my medley minutes for today, I just wanted to bring in a fun tidbit that I managed to secure the domain name last week of quackalopemonster.com. I'm hoping to do a lot of fun things with the IP.
What are you doing? What do you mean you took quackalopemonster.com?
Was this in contention at some
point? I've secured AlexanderRadcliffeSender3rd.com, and you just wait.
Oh, I've gotten Quackalope Monster with an O and with a U just to cover my bases.
Monster.
So for my medley minute, I'm actually just want to talk very briefly about Red Rising, which I'm sure everyone's already familiar with, but this is the newest Stonemaier game.
Oh.
Yeah, and I want to say that I think this one has less hype attached to it than many, but it's actually one of the ones I'm more looking forward to right now. Having watched a few playthroughs and followed it around, it does seem to be very much be on the lighter side, appealing to fans of the book who could hopefully be brought into gaming, as well as appealing to gamers as well.
Purchased because of this game. I'm intrigued. If I like the book, I want to pick up the game.
What an interesting order.
I plan on reading the book for the same reason. But like overall, the gameplay looks fun. It looks lighter, but it looks like it's all about hand management and card comboing and powers and abilities. I do not think it's going to win any major awards. I do not know if it's a game people will be talking about in 5 years. But I think like Mutants, which I talked about last week, I think it has the promise, the potential of being quick, accessible, fun, and rewarding. And maybe sticking around for a few years, maybe sticking around for longer, or maybe also disappointing. That's possible as well.
Yeah, I very much plan to bring this one to the channel at some point, assuming, of course, I enjoy the novel, which I'm going to start here soon. From my side of things, I'm actually, like you are, more intrigued by Red Rising than I have been by Tapestry or Pendulum, mostly because the hype around it seems like that bubble around Stonemaier Games seems to have been popped a little bit.
Yep.
And
yep.
I kind of can approach it with a little bit more skepticism than I did originally, which means the odds of me enjoying it more are higher. It's kind of like telling Jan he's not going to enjoy a game before he plays it.
But he's not.
That's true.
Why is everybody always assuming that I'm not going to enjoy a game or I'm going to love a game? I'm not that susceptible to other people.
No, we definitely make fun of it more than it reality is a thing, but it is a thing. You rotate your collection more than I do, and I'm a pretty big rotator. So we take the opportunity to make fun of it more than
I will admit I can be a little bit, like, for example, the other day I was walking through a store and I see a Switch game and I look at a friend of mine and I go like, "Hey, would you play this game with me?" They were like, "Yes." Okay, I'm going to buy the game. There was no conversation between or any research. So at the end of the day, I think there is a little nugget of truth in there. And it just hurts when it's highlighted.
Hey.
Yes.
Hey, I was that friend.
Jesse, stop. Monday. Okay.
But I was the friend.
Yeah. Okay. Wait, Jesse. Let's distract the audience before they start delving deeper into this. Okay. So
are you interested in a tiny, epic, mini, small box, super adventure game? What?
Itty bitty. So I'm not, but I know 11,524 people who are.
Yeah. So I'm bringing in on Kickstarter today. I mean, people that have followed the channel have probably seen a preview and a full gameplay go up. And over on Table Knots, there's going to be a full review that went up with my good friend Max and Doolin, his partner, of Tiny Epic Super Little Itty Bitty Dungeon Crawl, Tiny Epic Dungeons.
In other words, the only type of dungeon crawler that I might actually enjoy, is that
Jan,
what this is?
No, you don't like dungeon crawlers, and this one, if it is anything, it's a dungeon crawler.
But it seems like it's going to be a much more compact experience.
Jan.
Also, doesn't it have miniatures?
It does. It does have tiny
Isn't
little
this a
itty
tiny
bitty miniatures.
Epic game?
It's a tiny epic game with miniatures.
That's not a thing, though.
It is now a thing.
What was the game that was similar to Zelda? That didn't have miniatures, but it did have all, something
and close. Tiny Epic Quest.
It had meeples with weapons.
Exactly.
And now they have miniature meeples. Jan, listen. Here's the thing. I don't think you're going to like this game.
Oh.
For all the reasons why I think people who like and are looking for a small box dungeon adventure game are going to like this game. This game doesn't hold back. It packs so much little escalating tension and chaos and experience into this little dungeon delve that it doesn't really feel like a small box game. Now, one of the things that Gameling Games historically has done is packed more game into a tiny box than you'd naturally expect. Dinos is the one that comes to mind that surprised me at how good of a little kind of ecological system it painted in front of you. This little Euro, managing the resources of your dinosaurs on this tiny little island, and it felt so good and crunchy. Dungeons is doing the exact same thing here. It has all of the tropes that you're looking for in a dungeon delve experience, from escalating powers and abilities to brand new weapons, resources, shields, items, set of items, characters that feel a degree unique with their own special traits and powers that can be customized to be a rogue or an archer, can fight at a distance, can cast magic spells, and it'll be primarily operating off of a grid or tile system where you're exploring and delving into this region, fighting little goblins, popping them like zits, because goblins are mostly pus-fueled. You'll know that.
What a horrible image.
Listen. It's a gameplay reference. You'll understand if you just go watch our gameplay. And at the end, you're going to show down against this big boss. It is not a lightweight dungeon experience. Core Quest, as an intro dungeon crawler, is still my first and foremost suggestion for people who want to introduce this genre to people. But if you want something that can pop in your backpack and be a full game experience, this one's really, really well done. Now, Jan, the two things that I want to point out that are probably going to be interesting to you is the two mechanics of this game that are different or unique when it comes to a dungeon experience.
Is that one?
The boss,
yep.
And the torch track. The torch track is going to be this timing or pressure mechanic. It'll also be a thing that gives you perfect information on how creatures out on the field are going to be interacting with you, from spawning new ghouls and goblins to activating their special abilities and triggering all of them at the same time. Every time a player takes an activation, they'll be moving that torch track down. Now, when you collect certain resources, do certain actions in certain rooms, or destroy and take out certain enemies, you will be pushing that torch track up. Mm-hmm. There is a balance and equation that you always have to strike, because sometimes you can't push that torch track specifically because you don't want to trigger the next activation. If you do, it'll always continue shifting down, always continue activating whatever is directly in front of it. And you don't have enough time in this game. That torch track really genuinely feels like it's a pressure mechanic, like your light is dimming, and if you don't continue rushing through this space, it escalates the tension in such a good way. Now, the boss mechanic is going to be the other unique thing. You already pointed that out. There's going to be variable different bosses, but for the most part, they're going to operate by being unlocked, by taking out certain minions or accomplishing certain objectives, and then you'll flip their card over. That unlocks the room to their lair or their domain. When you enter into their lair or domain, your worker actually comes off of the battlefield and onto the boss card. You can then push yourself or move around the lair to get special abilities, do higher damage, or take a debuff depending on where you're positioned and standing. But the trigger, the real core part, is the bosses have a shield or a defense mechanic. Mm-hmm. So you can wound it a little bit, but at a certain point, you must leave the lair and do your very best to direct and draw the attention of that creature into the wider cavern. Some of them sprawling across multiple rooms, others just needing to stumble out into the open passageway, and then the real battle and real showdown can begin. It is surprising how much good they've put into such a small box.
I have so many different things and thoughts and questions I want to ask, but first few things. Have you, and this is both a question for you and Alex, have either of you ever played Set a Watch before?
Yes.
This game reminds me.
I have no idea what that is, but I personally don't wear watches. They bother my wrist.
Set a Watch is a game by Rock Banner Games that also has a similar mechanic where a campfire determines the amount of threat that's going to come in the next encounter. It's not necessarily a dungeon crawler. There's nothing like that. It's all card-based, but it is actually a really good, what I believe is mostly regarded as a solo game that includes that idea of constant pressure coming around you based on your decisions. So that's the first thing that I wanted to point out, which is a positive, because I played Set a Watch and it was awesome. I can't wait for the next expansion. In terms of the game, Jesse, one of the things that you're forgetting that I hate about dungeon crawlers is how portly or rotund or excessive they can be, how much they take to set up and tear down and all the pieces. And it's just so much. It's like, stop it. Bring it down. This is doing that. It's all fitting in a tiny little box. And
there are expansions, and they've done really, really well on Kickstarter. And so a tiny box is the core game, but there's certainly more boxes that you need to have everything.
But it'll never be the size of an actual dungeon crawler. And that by itself is something
that
gets
me. I have hope.
It gets me excited. I like that about this game, because one of the things that I've always enjoyed about dungeon crawlers is the idea of exploration, of modular building, of expansion, of never knowing what's next in that tile that you're going to flip, and trying to figure out that puzzle, which was also the other thing that I got really excited about Machina Arcana when Alex brought that in, right? I like those experiences that feel more like roguelite experiences in a dungeon setting. And I think this is hitting that really well. Like, I don't know. I'm excited about this. And so my most important question regarding
Jan,
this.
Again, I just don't think you'll like it.
I want to play it.
I do have to point out, well, I mean, yeah, but Jen, you probably won't like it. I do have to point out, though, I do like cooperative games, it turns out, just not some of them.
Okay, and here's the most important question, Jesse. You have played and you have covered. Alex, you're very quiet. I want to hear from you too.
Oh, I'm happy to jump in.
He's
I'm just waiting
being
for you
respectful
to finish your
to the
thing.
Birds.
Respectful of your time
oh,
and
how
attention.
Sweet of you, Alex. This is the last question, I promise. You have played every single tiny game so far, or at least the grand majority of them, Jesse. Where does this one fall? Yeah.
Galaxies was one of the very first games I was ever introduced to. I think it is a great introductory game and people love it. My favorites after that, well, actually the only one that's directly competed with Galaxies after that was Tiny Epic Dinosaurs. Dinosaurs is probably still at the top of my list at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I am very, very compelled by Dungeon. Dungeon, however, is also competing with other larger dungeons. And so while I think it's an incredible dungeon, it doesn't stand out as much as Dinos does, because Dinos is this little Euro puzzle. I think it's Euro. I'm not
it's
sure.
It's its own
Dinos
thing.
Dinos is this little puzzle that doesn't really compete with anything else in my collection, because I don't own Dino Land or Dino World or Dino Park.
I gotta introduce you to Dinogenics, buddy. You basically make a farm for dinosaurs.
I love farms, and dinos are
Jen,
all right.
I think you should play Tiny Epic Dinosaurs. It's much smaller and more accessible. It's not a big thing to get set up and play
it's
and
true.
Pack up and all
it's,
that.
I like... Okay, I hear you. Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, I think that you're... Your appeal of Tiny Epic Dungeons is why Tiny Epic as a series has done so well. It provides and promises and often delivers on giving you 85, 90, sometimes 95% of the experience of a big box game with a small percentage of the price, a small percentage of the footprint, a small percentage of the complexity. The problem for me has historically been that 5 to 15%.
You got too much space. You got so much space to fill, you might as well have the big one.
I want the extra game. I mean, there's the setup, I hear you. The cost is not the factor that's going to stop me. I want to jump into a dungeon with gigantic monsters and things to deal with and all that. That's what I'm looking for. The Tiny Epic series, historically for me, has given me most of what I'm looking for and a much cheaper price point and a much smaller table size, much smaller footprint, but not the experience I'm primarily looking for. Now, Tiny Epic Dungeons, I want to pay attention to. Tiny Epic Pirates, I want to pay attention to. I'm not done with the series. They have delivered solid game after solid game, and so I'll keep trying them to see whether there is one that hits it for me. But I think for me, Tiny Epic Dungeons feels like a veggie burger as opposed to a salad. And if you're wondering where I'm going with this, if you're wondering where I'm going with this, salads are delicious and have their own merit because they're very good at being what they're trying to be. But a veggie burger is just a slightly worse burger. And so I kind of want the burger and the salad, and I'm leaving the veggie burger behind.
I hear what you're saying 100%. Here's the interesting thing, though. Most people are not you, and most people are not me or Jan.
Actually, Jesse, all people except for myself are not me.
That's true. That is true. Most people are not you. Most people like birds. That being said, I would very comfortably advocate to people who are new into the hobby space, who have limited space to get something or store something in their house. I would have no problem saying that they're intrigued by this series of games. They're going to find something worth exploring. Now, the question is, do they move on at a later date to a larger dungeon crawl, to a new mechanic, to a larger farm building dino game? I think they probably do. But as a start to that conversation, or even as a continued experience for someone that just can't justify $500 in a box that fits the size of my SUV, it's so good. It's so good. I had so much fun. I mean, if you want to be convinced on this game, or you at least want to be like compelled by what the experience is like, go check out either one of the videos I did with Max. The amount of fun we had for 2 hours straight playing this game, that alone is such a selling point.
Just to be clear, was it a 2 hour experience for a single game?
We spent maybe an hour and a half on a single game.
Really? That blows my mind. I thought it would be like 45 minutes max.
No.
I mean, the game's rated at 30 to 60 minutes. It could just be it took longer. I don't know.
We were having fun, But no, I mean, I think we played fairly efficiently. A two-player game took about an hour and a half with a little bit of an introduction and a little bit of an ending. But it was fun. It was fun every second of the way. It was fun.
So, as I said, Jesse, I still really want to try this one. And Alex, I don't know. At the end of the day, we'll see what happens. I'm now going to bring in another game that's almost kind of breaking the rules like Jesse did in Shell for Cell.
It's technically
three games and only one Kickstarter. Today, I'm bringing in...
One Kickstarter counts.
I'm bringing in Moon Adventure in a Grove and Dokojong, the new collection of games by Oink Games, okay?
Oh.
And this is honestly...
You're a fan of these international indie titles.
Yes, yes, I am. And I'm not even sure if we can call Oink Games indie at this point, but... It's tricky. I don't know if this section of the conversation is going to be too long because I don't have a lot of information on each of these games, but I really just wanted to take a second to shout out that this is happening and how exciting it is that it's happening. So each of these games, two of them are going to be completely new titles from Oink Games, and one of them is a reprint and a reinterpretation of one of their more popular titles. So I'll do my very best to give you a little bit of an idea of what each of them is bringing, and then explain, at least in my own perspective, why this is cool. Innogrove is one of their more popular titles, and Innogrove is pretty much a deduction game based around numbers. What you're trying to do is guess what number is hidden on the table face down while trying to understand what all the players on your sides have. So ideally, you're trying to kind of make bets and determine who's the bad guy here. It's very straightforward, very simple, but it has proven to be a pretty fun experience. I personally have not played it, but I've heard great things about it. And it is one of those Oink games that just keeps coming back again and again. The next game that they're going to have is actually a reinterpretation completely of one of their previous titles. This one is called Moon Adventures, and I believe the first one was called Sea Adventures. In Sea Adventures, that was a competitive game where you were trying to race down a deeper and deeper sea levels to try and bring in treasure. And the idea was that it was kind of like a push your luck mechanic, because the deeper that you would go, you would find better treasures, but you will also, you know, could have the possibility of drowning and never reaching back to the submarine that would take you back to safety.
I've played this one. It's really good.
Right? And it's very small and simple and fun. So now they've gone ahead and re-implemented that game through a cooperative lens. Now that's called Moon Adventure. And in Moon Adventure, what you're trying to do is that you're trying to find parts of a broken ship to bring back to the vessel and escape the moon.
That's the term. That's the one I was thinking.
And escape the moon. And this time you're using a card system that everybody has, starts the game with cards, and those cards determine how much oxygen is shared amongst the players, and you're incentivized to make sure that you play cards at the appropriate time, and depending on the amount of things that you're bringing with you, that could potentially increase the amount of pressure or oxygen you're wasting. And also there's special roles similar to kind of like Pandemic and other cooperative games that we've seen. So it's a really interesting take on what I didn't even know that you could, that would, you would consider doing for a game that was already pretty successful in their lineup. And then the next one is actually one of the ones that I have the least information on, and this one is completely new, and I think it falls in their more simplistic, straightforward lineup, and it's called Dokojong. It is a dice-based game about just throwing some dice with dog faces that look absolutely adorable. Jesse, you should see these things. I think you'll really dig the overall look of it.
Hi, puppy.
And what you're basically trying to do, and I'll read this directly because it is just that straightforward, a short game where players try to guess where each other's dog is hidden among five tiles. You want to avoid revealing your dog's whereabouts, but if you overact to avoid guesses, your dog may be exposed. And that's basically it. That kind of reminds me a little bit of Nine Tile Panic.
I am currently going to back...
So speaking,
What's this collection called,
Jim? It's the Oink Games series. In fact, worth mentioning at this point, to those listening, you have like 1 or 2 days left to back this game. So if you are interested, jump on in before it's too late. Jesse, 48-hour warning, Jesse.
No, I'm going to discover where those dogs are hiding.
I think you have to back all of them together, Jesse. You can't just get the dogs. You have to get all of them.
I'm going to discover where those dogs are hiding.
So the reason why I'm bringing this in the first place is because I want to incentivize this type of international extension. I'm not sure what the particular word is here, but I want this to happen more often.
We're doing what we can to highlight. It's interesting because right now we live in the United States of America. One of us is from Canada. One of us is from Puerto Rico, but for the most part, this is our marketplace. Mm-hmm. And in other subsects of the world, you know, we have the European, the Australian, and probably the Central Asian marketplaces, with Japan being a subcategory of that, with a lot of incredible titles coming out. I have even seen some indie groups and indie designers coming out of Africa as well, which just have not had the bandwidth or the reach in order to break into the Western marketplace. And part of the thing that you focused on from the very beginning, Jan, has been this desire to see and experience and explore a variety of titles that maybe others here in the States just wouldn't discover for a variety of reasons: cultural tastes, distribution and logistics, and just general size of the company. I mean, think about the indie publishers that we have here in the States. A lot of those games don't make their way overseas, mm-hmm. and that's the same over in other regions and countries. So if we're able to, as Quackalope, to highlight, shout about, and encourage this type of cross-proliferation, I think it's super cool. The ideas and designs and experiences that come from vastly different regions of the world really, really, I mean, a lot of people would say, well, they're just games and all games play the same, but they're really different.
Yeah.
There's some really, really interesting design and mechanic choices being made that you don't currently see here in the States.
It's all about school of thoughts and what they prioritize in game design and how they make those decisions that completely change the landscape of what their titles are bringing. And yes, that is exactly the word that I was trying to use, the proliferation, the breaking of borders and bridging the entire design world into one is something that I really want to see more of. Specifically, Analog Lunchbox is one that I want to see here in the States. That is one of my favorite game companies.
Has kind of already bridged the gap to a degree. Small enough titles that can ship fairly easily, and they've, you know, entered into the more popular nomenclature. But there are a lot of publishers that are right on the edge of bridging that gap. That we hope to bring to the channel and the conversation down the road.
Aiden Games is another one that we talked about previously. That's another Japanese publisher that is slowly making their way to the West. They're in Gen Con, and we brought in Crash Octopus, which was another Kickstarter game.
Even Platypus Industries, with the Rat Catcher being his first title that was published. I mean, through the lens of Kickstarter, he was able to bridge out of that Australian marketplace, where he spent a lot of his time working for publishers within that region. So there's a lot of people and doing some very, very cool things. His next title is going to be called Drop Bears, I believe, and it's about how koalas consume tourists. It is so Australian, that, I'm bleeding.
That sounds absolutely amazing, and I am not typically pulled in by this animal stuff just across the board. But koalas eating tourists? Yeah. I mean, I'm in.
Alex, I saw the miniature for this game.
There's a mini?
There's miniatures?
Yeah, it's disgusting. It's terrifying. I no longer think I like koalas.
Wow.
I am in.
Oh, dude, and Ratcatcher is like genuinely really, really
good. So
good. It's so nice.
So all that being said, if you know or are or have connections with a indie international publisher, feel free to reach out, have a conversation. If we can and if we enjoy your game, we'd love to highlight and continue. It's one of the passions that Jan has that we're hoping to invest in and dig into farther as time goes on. That being said, Jan, let's hear what Alex brought in.
Yeah, what did you bring, Alex?
So I too am just find myself enamored with the idea of
small
big box experiences, yep, but with small box availability,
iterations,
small price, yes, points.
Oh god!
It doesn't take up too much table space.
You're doing
has
the
only
thing,
a handful of miniatures,
right,
to give you. I'm doing,
yeah,
the
you're
thing,
doing
sir.
The thing.
I am doing,
oh,
the
Lord,
thing. I of course am bringing in Zombicide, Undead or Alive.
Yeah, haven't heard
a
of
a game that by the time they have announced all their optional buys and add-ons and everything will squash a stack of what is it again? Tiny Epic Dungeons
and
in about
games
half
too.
A second.
It'll squash the entire catalog and collection of both the publishers that Jan and I,
yeah,
bought in.
Literally.
Here's the one thing that I can say about this game. They sure did choose a good company to represent the gameplay. I mean, just probably,
yeah,
just one of the best,
yeah,
just I am loving.
Absolutely.
The official,
they have one of the most charismatic individuals,
yes,
I've ever seen in a gameplay.
The official,
I believe Board Game Co. was his
the
name.
Official content that's coming out on behalf of CMON, is some of the best I've seen in our industry in years.
Wow. Wow. Big words, Jesse. I wonder who that is. Hmm.
Well, it's me.
Yeah, so Zombicide, Undead or Alive. I mean, Jesse, you've watched this game played. I've played this game.
True.
I've backed this game.
I love that I don't get to... Whenever we do things so the audience knows, on TTS, I act as the cameraman to film and make sure the audience has a good experience. So I feel like I've played this game. I haven't technically, but I have watched it two times through.
But they've also finally included a Quacklope mini, which I was so
Wait,
thrilled
what?
With. Yeah, there's a Quacklope mini. I'll send you a link after. It's this giant fatty with a camera thing on his back. It's like it's clearly they finally heard the calls. They're excited. I mean, people have been asked for a Quacklope mini for a while.
Oh, you
have
troll.
You seen it, Jesse? Have you seen the fatty
oh,
with the camera
I'm
thing
so
on his back?
I'm so upset with you.
Wow, that was rough, Alex.
All
wow.
right. Zombicide is a
no.
game that a lot of people are familiar with. And yes, I will be going on a diet and working out from this point forward. Zombicide is a game that a lot of people are very familiar with. So in this game, Alex, what are they changing?
Yes.
What are they iterating on that has your attention? Other than the theme, because I'm going to be honest, if I'm going to own
the theme is pulling a lot
if
of
I'm
going to
own
in.
A Zombicide, it is this Western story. I'm so sold on theme alone.
Yeah, so the theme is definitely, I mean, it's not a huge selling point for me. I mean, I do like it, but a lot of people are being seriously pulled in by this theme. Gameplay-wise, they're going back a step from Invader. Invader, to me, was a step back. And they're going, when I say a step back in terms of from Invader,
going
I mean that they're going a little bit closer. Yeah, yeah forward.
That
they're
wasn't
going closer
confusing.
To Black Plague. It was not at all confusing. I'm sure people are following
this
along
one
perfectly.
Is better, in your opinion, than some of the other iterations.
Correct. Hmm. It's better than Invader. I think to me, it's going back to that non-confusing part at all. To me, it's a step sideways from Black Plague. It is good.
Yes.
One that I'm happy
at
to add to my
point,
collection.
We're learning the polka.
Yeah, the polka. We're going forward, back, to the left, turn around again. And next, I want Zombicide Steampunk. Although, speaking of Zombicide Steampunk, have you seen the add-on they introduced?
It's Steampunk. I haven't seen the add-on, but I assume it has something to do with steam power and locomotives.
It has something to do with Steampunk. They have Steampunk Abomination, Steampunk Survivors, Steampunk Gear.
Yes!
I mean, I am so pulled in by it. I love Steampunk.
This is so exciting.
And so, Alex,
yes.
Let's be specific. What is different about this Zombicide beyond the theme?
So they're getting rid of doors entirely, further taken away from the setup, which in a way which I don't think I actually mind the way they're doing it. I'm always wary of changes from things I like in an attempt to streamline, but this one I think I'm okay with. They're getting rid of, or they're adjusting the way noise is handled so that noise is always the last noise. It's less fiddly and ultimately gives you the same thing. I think I'm a huge fan of the way they're doing that. Mm. And noise was always easy to manipulate. Now they're just taking it to, they're just making it easy to manipulate as far as the physical manipulation as well as the gameplay manipulation. Past that, they're adding this train mechanic, which is very intriguing so far. I mean, I love the idea
it
of giant trains running over zombies.
Barrels through the center can carry you off of the map and squashes anything in its path. What's not to love?
But
exactly.
Is that a single map, or is that every single scenario?
All the maps, seemingly all the maps or most maps will have the train. The way the train interacts with
does
the scenario
change.
Will vary.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah. Past that, they don't have necromancers or something like that. They instead have a spawn points that will be added to the board as you enter buildings. You're going to add spawn points, and you have to get rid of them, because if you ever have 7 spawn points, you will lose right away. So they're doing a whole bunch of changes like that. Lots of steps sideways. Overall, I like it. My biggest concern is based on the one scenario we played, that I didn't feel the board had a lot of maneuverability. It kind of felt like you were like at the showdown. Central pathway.
Yeah,
I felt more like a showdown. And have a lot of, like, one of my things that I love in Black Plague is the ability to both engage the zombies when you need to, as well as run away from the zombies when you need to. And that gives you a lot of that maneuverability. I didn't feel that the one scenario we played had that. But again, the one scenario we played.
Yeah, I think with a wider map and maybe different objectives, that could change slightly. But that being said, I think part of the reason why it felt like that is very much so, in our experience, that train was our main objective. And so all of the corners of the map contained little side quests that we had to accomplish. But at the end of the day, move the Gatling gun to the center, hold down the line, draw people in, squash them with the train, and then hop on the train and escape does mean that everything was focused into that middle region, which lessens how much maneuverability or how much dodging and ducking you're doing.
Yeah.
And so, Jesse, what did you think of about this zombie side game?
I have historically not been the biggest fan of Zombicide.
Mm-hmm.
My initial experience with it was fairly lackluster, and Alex has clarified that I also played the worst possible way to play the game. I was operating with one single character as a brand new player with a group of experienced players, which meant my turn ended in a nothing burger.
Sure.
When it comes to this experience so far, I was much more compelled by the gameplay that I was able to, you know, hang out with and experience on TTS. I love the theme and the idea behind it. I like the upgrading and cascading weapons. I think the train was really cool. And I think they simplified some things that, for me, I might not have enjoyed as much in other iterations. I am much more intrigued and excited to experience Black Plague with Alex, which I have promised will be the next time that I play Zombicide. I'm still holding back. I'm partial. I don't know that it is 100% the right game for me. What I do know is I did enjoy this experience more than my initial one, and so I'm definitely more compelled. And if I like Zombicide, if I determine that it's a game I want in my collection, I think this version of it is going to be the one that I add.
So the one thing I'll say about this is that I continue to not be a big fan of Zombicide, but I am very curious now about Black Plague. So that's definitely one thing.
That's the one Alex keeps swearing by.
Yeah.
Well, less swearing, it's so far more my favorite. Saying that he likes it.
Yeah, I want to play Undead or Alive a lot more to see how it plays out, but we'll see how it goes.
So the one thing I was going to say is that I really like this the direction that CMON has taken for some of their game titles. I think that Starcadia was one of these where they oversimplified a little bit and took away from some of the magic that the original Arcadia Quest had. So I don't know. I want them to keep revisiting these titles with a little bit more carefulness, I would say. So I don't know. I'm all for this exploration.
Here's an interesting thing that I have discovered over the course of the last year. For a long time, without playing many of their games, I sort of wrote CMON off as the publisher that always did giant boxes of miniatures with okay gameplay, and everyone backed them because they liked minis. Just the, you know, churn and burn publisher on the platform. And here's the thing. Over the last year, partially due to being in association with Alex and doing more official gameplay with CMON, let's be fair, I have played a lot of their titles. And I think they are one of the most consistently good publishers I have came across. It doesn't mean everything's right for me, but I have been very, very impressed with the quality of content that they've put out outside of the miniatures. The gameplay experiences, I have multiple of their titles that are competing for spots in my top 10 off of the last year's experience alone.
I will say this, though. Right now, they are in. I think they have different phases where they're experimenting with design, and other phases where they just know what's going to be successful and try to build up their wealth with that.
I want to see what the next push or the next experiment is going to be. That was Dogs of War, was one of those experiments. Potion Explosion was Simon as well when they were experimenting a little bit.
Well, The Last of Us may well be the next experiment. I don't know how they're going to play it.
Compelled.
Well, they could just lean into some of the mechanics that they already know work. We don't know what they're doing with that yet. Like Truvung, I think, was one of the last true experiments that they've done, right?
I disagree. I mean, I think they've put out new experiences with a lot of the titles they've published this last year.
Oh, that's true. With the animation.
From Massive Darkness to the animation studio, even Marvel showing up was such a simple, accessible game with a depth to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have been shocked how impressed I've been with the quality of their publications. I understand why Alex is the biggest fan of theirs I've ever met.
Yeah, no, seriously, I genuinely am. They consistently put out games that are both fun, pretty, attractive, hold their value, all the things I'm looking for in a board game. Now, they have put out games that weren't for me either. Arcadia Quest was a game that did not stay in my collection. Bloodborne was a game that did not stay in my collection. Not all publishers are going to be 100% for every
on
person all the time.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, there are a handful of companies that when they put out a game, I am paying attention, knowing that I will enjoy it, questioning whether I will keep it, but knowing that I'll enjoy it. And Simon is definitely one of them.
Yeah. Well, those of you that have made it to this part of the episode, first off, I have two things that I want to mention. I want to let you know that we're going to be going into listener comments right after the next interlude. And if you want to be part of this conversation, we'd love to have that conversation with you. That was a weird way to say it. It'll lead to my second point. Swing over to theweeklyquack.com, leave a comment, or join our Facebook group, The Quackalope Podcast. We love engaging in conversation and interaction and just spending time with you, the fan base. We also are figuring out how to grow, adapt, and develop this podcast show, so we'd love your feedback and for you to give us some insight on that. If you enjoy this program, take a second to let us know about it, because it'll really inform the way that we continue producing it. That leads to my second main point. Did you notice something slightly different about this episode? Depending on how much editing work Jan did, we're doing a bit of an experiment. Normally, we have more takes and retakes, resets, and we do our best to make it as clean and polished as possible. But that extra 5% takes Jan probably 5 or 6 additional hours sitting behind the computer editing. And with some of the major changes coming to both of our platforms, Alex introducing a top shot and B-roll into his footage, and myself discovering a window, it is much more difficult for us to justify that resource of time. And so this episode was the very first one that we've done that still has local recording, but doesn't have a overly aggressive editing hand. If you didn't mind that, if it was an enjoyable listen, also give us a note. Or if you noticed it during the episode and quality was down to a degree where it was bothersome, I'd really be interested in that feedback. If no one responds, we're just going to keep getting worse from here until at least one of you does. All that being said, thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. And like I said at the beginning, I'm a duck and ain't no one going to convince me otherwise.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.
Okay, so for audience feedback today, we're only going to take one question because today's show was, we had a lot to say, everybody, a lot to say. So today's question is going to be really challenging, guys. So I would recommend that if you have either your board games next to you or your BGG list, you're going to want to bring it up because you're definitely going to need it.
I own neither, but I'm ready.
Okay. Socrates Palacios was such a new commenter on the website, so thank you very much for that, Socrates. For some people, shelf space might be an issue. I was having a conversation with a friend who is currently running out of space for his board games. I wonder if that friend was me. We came up with a scenario. What if you had was only a 2x2 Kallax shelf? What games from your current collection would go in it? keeping in mind...
2 feet by 2 feet?
It's like 4 squares total.
Okay.
Keeping in mind...
Can it overhang?
No. It is just a 2x2 Kallax. Keeping in mind...
I'm cutting Kingdom Death in half.
Oh, I've solved this already.
Keeping in mind box sizes, maybe one or two bigger box games could fit on top of the shelf. So there you go, okay. Jesse. Okay. We then thought of, and then this is a little bit extra. We then thought about games that come in smaller boxes, but offer a lot of game. What comes to mind for you guys? For me, Orleans and Brass Birmingham retail version that doesn't come with the iron clays, making the box pretty slim. Both of those boxes aren't too big and would definitely go in my shelf. This is a good one. So I'm going to, go ahead, Alex, take it away.
There's a lot here. So I'm not going to answer this overly in depth because I didn't come prepared with, you know, a degree of homework, but excluding amusing answers such as Zombicide period or how long is the Kallax shelf? How deep does it go or magical stuff? But going for pure simplicity, I would say just off the top of my head, a rattling of games that I think would fill a large portion of my collection while being reasonably sized would be Blood Rage, Innis, Terraforming Mars, Marvel Champions, Spirit Island. I can go through a few more.
I mean, you can't list, just filled it.
You can't list all the good games.
Well, no, I'm trying to think through a variety of games that hit me on solo play, on team play, on two player, on groups.
Yeah, but your whole list there was excellent.
I know it was excellent. It's a 2x2 shelf. It better be excellent.
Yeah, exactly.
This is it. This is all that sticks around. Nothing else is here.
Yeah.
Lost Ruins of Arnak, that game is wonderful. People should definitely get their hands on that one. I don't know. I'd have to go through, I'd have to really dig through, but there's a decent amount of games that I could fit into a 2x2 grid that would give me a lot of gaming
and
fun.
Interesting.
Would it accomplish everything? No, it wouldn't. I mean, a 2x2 is going to eliminate a lot of fun things. I mean, I'd probably shove Cthulhu Death May Die in there. I might say goodbye to Zombicide. It's an interesting experiment, this idea of minimalism in games. It's not what I'm looking for in my collection. I love the variety, but if I were forced to, I can make it work.
Okay. Kingdom Death is going on top.
Yep, 100%.
And a pile of the shelves are going to be used to harbor the Kingdom Death expansions.
Oh my gosh.
So I think I have one shelf left. What, Jen? You asked me the question. I'm saying what I would honestly do.
No, Jesse, honestly, if it's all expansions, you get everything. That's it. You just have a shelf
Death. Because the expansions can be slimmed down to just the components, which would fit on one of those 2x2. So I have one 2x2 left. I'm thinking I include Wingspan, Everdell, and Blood Rage.
Everdell is a great choice.
And Blood Rage.
Blood, wow.
I think those three, alongside Kingdom Death, I could spend...
You really have Wingspan up there?
Yes. I could
you
spend...
You heard him. And also next to its immediate competitor, which is fascinating.
Let me finish my sentence.
Oh, you're asking for people to not interrupt, huh? Really? Yeah,
Listen. Uh-huh. You didn't clarify.
Jesse? What have I not clarified for you? Huh?
I think I could spend a solid 6 months playing just those four games, potentially even 12 months, and I would be okay.
You didn't put Terraforming Mars on the list.
Terraforming Mars is incredible, but again,
I would swap that for Wingspan.
I understand, but I don't know. I chose my titles. Don't question me.
Okay, so this, Alex, I think you brought a really interesting question.
The shelf is so small.
Usually when you have a library, you want to keep in mind all the types of players that you're going to bring into your table. So I don't I guess I'm going to be very selfish with the games I choose from my own library to go here. But I heard what Alex said and I might pivot a little bit. So the games I would bring in 100%. One of them will be Brass Birmingham and Great Western Trail. Don't know if it's a second edition or not. I just know Great Western Trail is going in there. Bunny Kingdom. Chinatown is definitely going in there. I think I probably have Alex, when sometimes some games, depending on the Kallax, you have a little space in front of it. I think I would include maybe the Crew in front of that. I would include in there also, let's see, Five Tribes. Absolutely love it. I would have in there,
I think on top of the shelf, it's
You're running out of space. Yeah, you got the top left.
You put five tribes in there? That's pretty impressive.
I love five tribes, bro. I have the entire collection.
I love five
collection.
Tribes. I don't like it that much.
I have the entire collection. I absolutely love five
Same
tribes.
Same here, but that's a level of
We need
love.
To play.
I don't have these huge box games because the only huge box game that I think I would keep and I would put on top is going to very likely be Project
Millennium
Elite.
Blades.
No, what? Project Elite, because Millennium Blades would fit on one of those shelves. And I think now I'm running out, very much so. Monsterlands is going in there.
You've got to burn one of these games.
Nine tile.
Oh, you know what I'm throwing in there? This is cheating, but I'm throwing Primal in there for sure.
Oh, that could go on top,
Alex. It
doesn't
fit. It definitely, it has to go on top.
Yeah, that would go on top.
Okay, I'll throw it on top. But honestly, the truth is, I actually don't know if I would. As much as I do like Primal, Marvel Champions does fit that spot. And if I'm trying to be conservative, I guess I wouldn't put Primal in there.
Marvel Champions
sadly.
Is excellent. If I have a little bit of space left, I'm going to add in Cockroach Poker, the King Edition, or whatever it is.
Ooh, you could just put choice. That in front of something.
Yes,
Nine
yes.
Tile
and
Panic.
It's such a good you must own.
Nine Tile Panic, Quacks of Quendlingburg.
You're out of space.
No, I feel I
you
have
can't
more.
Read, you can't read your BGG page and say you're keeping
Jen,
them.
Jen, I feel you took this question more literally in terms of the precise amount of
He's
square footage.
Exactly.
Measured.
Exactly.
Either of
course
us.
He knows exactly how much space
yes,
this is.
Yes, because I own a Kallax. I know what four cubes gives me. It gives you at least 4 to 5 games per space. I think that might be it. I think that might be like my ultimate. And oh, Jesse, what about viticulture? It has to go in around somewhere, right?
Oh, viticulture is lovely, but luckily all my friends will own it. I don't need to own it.
Should I get that one to the table? I watched your playthrough and I was like, I need to play
that
game.
Here's what we'll do, Alex. When Jan and I visit, we'll play viticulture.
I also have the expansions that everybody wants us to
I'm
play.
I'm so excited. Well, I mean, you don't even need to bring your copies. I have the expansion and the base game, so feel free to save a trunk space.
We know it. We'll play it with you when we come.
I'm excited. I'm so excited. You just saved me the
so
rules.
Jesse, why are we talking about us going to get other things? Why is that?
That? Hey, audience, pay attention this Monday. Everything's changing.